Yeah. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for joining me on StashMyComics.com podcast number 22, The Double Deuce, just like Roadhouse. Oh my God. So excited. We need a bouncer now. So is anybody here a bouncer? No? Okay.
No.
It's a classic movie. It's in my my collection, so to speak.
Yeah, we've seen the rest of your collection.
Oh, heaven.
Is it sitting next to Maximum Overdrive by James?
It's actually sitting next to the Mighty Ducks.
Okay. Wouldn't they be in alphabetical order?
No, they're in genre. That's the way I like it.
Oh, excuse me.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a full podcast.
Wait a second. You're in genre and Mighty Ducks is next to Roadhouse?
Like childhood action. But that's not the point. The point is that we're all back together again. We've got me, your host, Tip Morse. With me, as always, is Kelly. Kelly, how you doing?
I am great. How are you?
I'm fantastic, actually. I'm resting comfortable in the fact that the Mighty Ducks are forever protected by Dolman. I want to welcome back Jason Martin, our editor at StashMyComics.com. Welcome back to the show, Jason. It's been a little while.
Yeah, I just... can't get over your organizational style for your movies.
I'm not up for debate here. Right beside Jason is Tom. Tom, welcome back. You're not stuck in traffic today.
No, I'm not stuck in Brooklyn, Manhattan traffic today. I'm not. No. Hello, America and Canada.
Wait, and Canada, our brothers.
And Guam.
Yeah,
we have a very strong following in Guam.
Let's not forget our friends in Puerto Rico, too.
They hate us in Puerto Rico. Whatever, okay.
Okay, so last week, Tom, you chose a rather unique issue for us to review, and unfortunately you were stuck in traffic, so you weren't able to take part in the review of that. But Jason has some viewpoints on that issue himself, so I want to let you two kind of hash it out for a couple of minutes. This is the grudge match, ladies and gentlemen. It should have happened last week, but it didn't because Tom was stuck in traffic and Jason was doing other stuff. But right now, we're going to give Tom and Jason the chance to talk about All-Star Batman and Robin number 9. Jason, you go first.
What a terrible issue. Just absolutely terrible. I can't believe that came out of Frank Miller's brain.
It did not blow me away. I mean, it did in the sense that it was not what I was expecting, but
it blew you away.
Well, we've talked about this at length, but Tom, I have to ask you, why did you choose that specific issue?
Okay, so a lot of people don't like All-Star Batman and Robin, I think.
You know, a lot of people don't.
I do, because it features the goddamn Batman in every issue and crazy Batman. Here's why I do like All-Star Batman and Robin. Look, aside from the fact that Jim Lee art and the art is gorgeous.
The art is fantastic.
Well, the art is beautiful. It's beautiful art. But the reason I like the book is that it's, first of all, it's a completely unique take on Batman you've never seen before. In that, and it kind of fits into, if you think of what Batman would have to be in real life, it kind of fits that he's this crazy, almost sociopathic dude, and if someone actually had the cojones to dress up as a bat and beat up criminals, that's kind of who they'd have to be. They wouldn't be all there. They wouldn't be in touch with, you know, a society. Now, I understand the comics, it's fantasy, it's for fulfillment. You don't need the protagonist to be that way. But it's a nice out-of-continuity exploration of that particular psyche in the Batman guys. I like that.
The way that I saw it was that it was totally, at least through the first three quarters of that issue, it was totally out of character for both Hal Jordan and Batman. The only one that was kind of in character a little bit was Robin, and then he was even out of character when he slapped Green Lantern right in the throat and crushed his windpipe.
See, but they see that right there, that way, right there, not that particular moment, but that's right. Why I picked this issue in particular. Because here's the thing. Robin, and this goes into kind of what I want to see in the next Batman film. Robin is important to the character when he's best done because he shows that the Batman, who's sort of steeped in darkness, needs this light, and mm-hmm. Robin symbolizes that light. But Robin was created because, you know, editors of the book felt that the younger readers who were their bread and butter needed a child character to relate to. So now we're trying to explain for the next 50 years, well, why does a preteen kid dress up alongside this guy dressed as a bat to fight crime?
And what was it Paul said last week, Kelly? It was because of Stockholm Syndrome. Was that right?
Yeah.
Stockholm Syndrome. Wait. Well,
where?
Yeah, I understand what it is. Yeah, but in what kind of, for this particular run or for the overall idea?
No. For what Miller was trying to accomplish in All Star Batman and Robin.
There's some of that, but I think what works here is that when Robin crushes Green Lantern's larynx and Batman realizes what he's done, he takes, you know, the next part where he takes him to the grave and lets the kid finally cry and mourn his parents. I think what we're seeing there, in my interpretation anyway, what we're seeing there is, oh, okay, well, Robin is going to ground this guy, the psychopath, in a bat suit.
We're
going to see why they need each other. That's why I like this issue, because it's where you see Batman sort of becoming closer to the Batman we know. He's being humanized because he's decided to recruit this kid into his war on crime.
That was honestly my favorite part of the issue. But we're leaving somebody very important out. Jason, what are your thoughts on this?
Aside from the fact that it was terrible? Look, it's definitely Frank Miller giving his finger to comics and saying, this is the Batman I'm going to write. You can go to hell or you can read it. I see what you're saying, Tom, about, you know, it's like how he would become, or you'd have to be crazy to dress up like a bat and go out and put your life at risk to do what he does. But like Tim said, he's just totally out of character. He's laughing and smiling and making jokes.
The lemonade kind of did it in for me.
Well, the fact that everything was painted yellow did it in for me.
That was a little bit of Frank Miller. It's not only that wasn't only Frank Miller giving comics the finger. That was Batman giving Green Lantern the finger. And this Batman has the Batman he's crafted here has such a superiority complex to all of the other heroes that are assembled. And there's the issue in the room with the Justice League, and they're all out of character. You know, I think it's a really fascinating take on this universe. On what we know in DC continuity, I know they're out of character. I know they're not what traditionalists want to see, but it's more interesting than telling the same story again.
Could it be said that Miller's Batman, at least in All-Star Batman and Robin, is borderline Lex Luthor? Like, it just takes that one push to push Batman over the edge, but nothing has happened yet. Like where you said before, you know, that this Batman is just given the finger to Green Lantern specifically. I mean, like, him sitting there drinking the lemonade and painting the whole room yellow, knowing full well that it's not just the color yellow. But do you understand what I'm saying?
I don't know if I can see him being one push away from Lex Luthor. I don't think the book glorifies his behavior. Robin, Dick Grayson, throughout the entire 12, 13 issues of the run, mm-hmm. you know, and while being terrorized, I forgot what it was, while being terrorized by Batman, he also calls him on all of his craps. Like, right. Why are you using that stupid voice? Seriously, you call us the Batmobile? That's so queer. You know, it's taking, you know, the tough guy Batman and sort of putting a needle into the balloon, so to speak, and then in this issue particularly, and why I picked this one in particular, it's showing, well, no, that this model of hero, of vigilante, is broken, and the two of them are going to need each other to coexist properly.
Well, Jason, do you have anything final to say before we move on?
Yeah. Where this whole series lost me, I think it was issue one, maybe, was it, or is it two? Whatever, after he's already kidnapped Dick Grayson and take him to the cave, and he just leaves him there. And then he gets pissed at Alfred for feeding him, you know, fast food or whatever. And he's like, no, he's supposed to survive on rats or whatever, and Alfred says something about it. He's like, and Batman's like, well, I did. And Alfred's like, no one made you do that. Like, I don't understand how that's good writing. Like, it just,
What is bad writing about it to you?
I think that bleeds into the end of this issue where Bruce Wayne realizes what he's done, you know, and it's those last four pages that kind of sum up all that not good writing and into that one aspect of, you know, I turned this kid into exactly what I didn't want to turn him into. You know, I trained him, I made him this cold, calculating machine that is ready to kill. You know, he's ready to cross that line that I'm not ready to cross.
I will say this, though. Jim Lee's art is fantastic.
It is gorgeous. It's gorgeous.
I'll go as far as to say that I would love for the next Batman franchise to be from Dick Grayson's point of view and be tell this story.
That'd be nice. That'd be nice. But we're going to leave it there for a second, guys. We're going to take a break for a minute, and then we are going to come to some news. Mainly, the big deal about Rob Liefeld versus Scott Snyder versus Greg Capullo. What in the hell is going on? We'll be right back in just a second.
Stash my comics.
Stash my comics.
Stash my comics.
Powered by Geek Energy.
Okay, so last week we talked about Rob Liefeld dropping his three books at DC Comics and leaving. For whatever reason, we didn't know about it at the time of the recording of the podcast, but we definitely do now. No thanks to Rob himself. Rob was glorious enough to air his dirty laundry on Twitter for everybody to see, and in the process, try and take down Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo, the creative team behind the current Batman run right now. Kelly, let's talk about that for a second. Did you read any of the explosiveness that is Rob for why he left DC Comics?
Yeah, I looked at some of his tweets. I don't think it's very professional of him to be tweeting about, like, the company he was working for and, like, the people he was working with. Like,
that he's still getting paid by until the issues he's completed come out.
Yeah. It's definitely, like, biting the hand that feeds you. And it's also just, like, rude because, like, he's talking about, like, his, like, editor that he got fired, and I'm like, that's not cool. I mean, as inept as he says they were, I mean, it's just very unprofessional to, like, who you worked with that way.
Right, right, absolutely. And looking at some of the tweets that, I hate that word, tweet. Looking at some of the Twitter responses that both him and Snyder did to each other, I mean, I'll give you guys just a taste of it, you know, and it starts out with Rob kind of going like this, you know, talking to Snyder, saying, it's not you, it never has been, it's Batman, in reference to saying that the reason why Batman is selling so well is not because of the story that's being written or the artwork that's put into it, but because it's the character itself. That's true to a point, but it definitely has something to do with Scott and Greg being a major part of that. And Scott says, you know, I can assure you, Batman doesn't sell the way it does because it's Batman. It sells that way because of me and Greg, referring to him and Greg Capullo. Rob, right after that, get over yourself, you pretentious whatever. And then, you know, saying, being berated in direct messages by Scott Snyder this morning, excuse me if I don't marvel at your amazing abilities to write Batman.
He didn't say whatever.
Well, I'm not going to say what he said.
Oh, sorry.
I'm saying verbatim.
Right. But, okay, Tom, let's jump into this. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I guess we can add leaving gracefully to the list of things Rob Liefeld can do, along with drawing feet.
Wow. I wasn't going to bring it up. I wasn't going to bring it up, but Tom, you did. So.
Hey, I've never been, look, I think Rob Liefeld probably takes more crap than he should. On the other hand, I've never been a Rob Liefeld fan myself in terms of either his writing or his artwork, even back when he was hot doing X-Force in the 90s.
Right.
I mean, in general, this is clearly not the most professional thing for him to be doing on his way out the door at DC. You could take it two ways. You could take it either Rob Liefeld is a whatever, Or you could take it as he was so frustrated and so fed up with how things were run over at DC, he couldn't help himself, which in case, which of course you still go back to, well, he's kind of a whatever, because have some self-control, dude. But I do agree with him a little bit that Batman's going to sell because it's Batman.
It is, but you've also got to admit that the storyline that Snyder wrote and the artwork that Capullo has put into it has to be at least some reason why Batman has sold so well and has helped to maintain the popularity.
Sure, of course. I'm not saying that these guys, look, I haven't read the story, so I'm not saying these guys have done a good or bad job at all, but there is something true to what Liefeld's saying in that, hey, Batman's always going to sell. Batman. It's true. It's absolutely true. That said, I mean, he's not going to win any awards for Mr. Congeniality.
No, that's definitely true. Jason, jump in on this. What are your thoughts on the whole Rob Liefeld debacle?
Yeah, I'm professional. But like Tom said, he has a point that Batman is going to be selling. But if you put a crappy story, crappy art in Batman, you might sell, whatever, like 80,000 copies. You put a great story with great artwork in it, it might sell, you know, twice that. So it doesn't matter. It's not so much what he said, it's just how he went about airing his grievances or his frustrations, where he... It's one thing to attack the editorial staff, it's another to go after your fellow writers and your peers in the industry.
That's right.
Especially when, you know, like Tom said, he can't draw feet.
but I mean,
look, I will say, I do want to say this. Snyder did have the best response ever. Let me find it.
How did they get started going off on each other? How did Snyder get dragged into this?
Liefeld said it's not you, it's Batman, it's always Batman, or something like that. Snyder direct messaged him. It was all private at this point.
Yeah, I've got all and that
said,
right here too.
Yeah, and said, you know, he was trying to just figure out why Rob was saying what he was, and after he said he was the head Batman writer, which apparently that's true. Anybody that's writing Batman is the head writer. Liefeld said, you are bleeping crazy, aren't doing this in private anymore. And then he brought it all out, which that to me, that's just really, if it starts out in private, it should stay in private. For him to air out the dirty laundry like that, it's really unprofessional. But
it's like what
Snyder did have the best one, the best one-liner was, and you can put that in your pouch and keep it for later.
Oh, does Liefeld draw a lot of pouches?
He draws lots of pouches.
Just a couple.
How many pouches does Deathstroke have? Do we need to count this? Or Kelly, can you tell us how many pouches Grifter has currently?
I'd have to bring up a picture.
Or even Hawkman, for that matter, who never used pouches to begin with, but now has that massive armor and really squinty eyes. But anyways, Paul said it best last week when he said that Liefeld was handed the keys to the kingdom at such a young age, and I personally don't think that he's grown up since then. I mean, he's 5 years away from 50 now, and that's great that he's still in touch with his childhood and stuff like that and still such a young and vibrant feeling person. But, I mean, come on. There's a certain measure of professionalism that needs to be there. I mean, Jason, you're the editor of Stash My Comics blog, and I write content for that, as does Tom and Kelly. I mean, how good would it bode me if I started throwing stuff like that at you? It wouldn't do me any good, because I wouldn't get anything published, for one, and for two, that'd ruin one hell of a friendship. I mean, it's stupid, to be honest.
I want to bring this up, and see, I thought initially when I heard that he was leaving DC, I was like, oh, okay, so he's going to try and go back to Marvel, especially with all the the talk of the new Deadpool game and, you know, Deadpool movies. I was like, oh, okay, so he's going to try and cash in on this. Well, then he had to go after Marvel editor Tom Brevoort.
Yes, how did you win that?
Yeah, Look, to me, if you can have what he had with Snyder, and you can go back and forth and be witty about it, it's one thing. But him just going after Tom Brevoort saying, oh, well, you're just fat.
Well, see, like, let's take it a step back for a second.
That's how children argue.
The reason why he did that, though, is because somebody had asked Tom if he would take Rob. And Tom had said something along the lines of, after what he did leaving DC, I'm not going to get on that train. And then Liefeld got wind of that and immediately started attacking the man. Not for his professionalism or anything he's done in the industry, but for the way he looks and things like that. And that just, I lose all respect for people when they start doing stuff like that. So let's get some final thoughts. Kelly, go ahead and give me some final thoughts on the awesomeness or unawesomeness that is Rob.
Very unawesome.
Okay.
It's unprofessional, and he kind of, like, ruins, like, any camaraderie he would have with any, like, of his peers that are also in the field.
He burnt a very big bridge, and I don't think that this one can be repaired. Tom, final thoughts for Rob Liefeld versus Scott Snyder versus Greg Capullo, who never really said much of anything.
Rob Liefeld is almost 50?
Yep.
Oh, I feel old. All right, I'm done.
Well, I mean, when we were kids, you know, when we were still in high school is when...
I know.
Not me.
Before Kelly was conceived.
Wow.
Yeah, so, Kelly, what year were you born?
1992.
Wow.
That's when X-Force came out.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
I was in middle school.
So I graduated 8th grade.
I was 4.
I graduated 8th grade in 2007.
Wow.
I had the same job I have now.
In 2007, I was down here. In Tennessee. But, okay, we're getting off track here.
No, people love this.
We don't care about Rob. We don't give two snots about what he's doing. He's going to fall. He's going to land on his feet. He's got Extreme Studios at Image. I mean, that's still doing his redundant material, Bloodstrike, which I think the creative team that's on Bloodstrike right now is actually doing a pretty good job. And Profit is getting a lot of praise, mainly because Liefeld's not on those series. He can't add his creative influence to ruin them. But Jason, take the last word on this. Final thoughts on Rob Liefeld.
I don't know that there's anything really more that we can say. I mean, I don't really feel bad for the guy. Like, if this kind of ruins his career with the big two, I don't feel bad for him because he caused it all. But at the same time, I don't want him to, like, lose his way of making money.
I don't think he's going to lose anything.
If anything, he can just go to cons from now on and draw oddly proportioned characters with no feet and sell those for, like, $100 a piece.
Right on. I'd like lots of pouches. Lots of pouches.
I haven't bought a Rob Liefeld book in 20 years, and I don't think that this is going to change that. So.
I bought one for a quarter a couple months ago.
I'll send you one.
Okay.
For $50?
Real quick. Yeah.
We're going to do a review of a Liefeld book next week.
Okay. Real quick, but before we go, I want to give about a quick minute and a half, 2 minutes to this. S.H.I.E.L.D., the really neat government organization in Marvel, the cinematic universe and in the comic books, they're finally going to get a live-action television show on ABC. Joss Whedon is set to help pen that with his brother, and there are rumors that he's going to direct it. Real quick, Kelly, what are your thoughts on that?
I'm really, really, really excited.
Oh, my.
And I hope they have Clark Gregg for Coulson.
That's a big hope, though, because he's dead, according to the movies, so if they do anything, it'll have to be in flashbacks. But, Jason, thoughts? S.H.I.E.L.D. live-action television show? Good or bad?
Wait, is Joss Whedon doing TV again? And it's like a group setting? Yes. Who's not on board with that?
Anybody that's a fan of DC?
There's a couple people I follow on Tumblr.
I think that's
Joss Whedon.
Right. But, see, I've never watched Firefly, so.
What is? We need to stop this podcast right now.
But you've seen.
You've watched all of them.
But you've seen Maximum Overdrive, right?
Right, I have.
Oh, thank God.
Well, yeah. There
we go. Wow, you're just redeemed.
Tom, what are your thoughts on a S.H.I.E.L.D. live-action television show?
Did you see the scene on Yahoo, the alternate opening to the Avengers? I guess it's going to be on the DVD.
I did not.
It is Maria Hill being interrogated by those faceless people on the screen.
Oh.
And it's like, it's after the events of the movie have already taken place. And it's talking about how Nick Fury screwed everything up. And it looks like it could be the opening scene to that TV series.
That would be good, because then they could explore Maria Hill as a character.
And it felt very you know those things Bendis would put into like the back of his issues when he was doing that Secret War series, and it would be like the debriefing of different characters. Yeah. It felt a lot like that.
Wow. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. But series S.H.I.E.L.D., good.
Yeah, all right. So we're all on board with the fact that this is a great idea, even though it's coming out on ABC.
Lost is on ABC.
Right, but ABC...
Once Upon a Time is really good.
ABC is owned by Walt Disney, so...
Once Upon a Time, you mean Fables?
No, it's like way tamer than Fables.
Okay.
All right, we're going to take a break for a second, but when we come back, we're going to do the poll list, the two comic books that we chose to review for you, the reader. We've got Gambit number 1, the new series that's out right now, and we take it back a couple of years to Spider-Man Blue number 1. We'll be right back in just a second.
Hi, Grandpa. Hey, Grandpa, say, have you ever used StashMyComics.com?
Grandpa.
I know they didn't have the internet when you were born, Grandpa, 7,000 years ago, but now they do. Thank you. And you should go on an internet, Grandpa, to StashMyComics.com and catalog your comic books. Actually, it's completely free to use. Even all the interactive features, such as the member reviews. Well, I thought you'd never asked. They do have a blog with daily reviews and editorial content, as well as a weekly podcast. Yes, I too will go make a donation to this internet comic book webpage in order to keep the service free. It has suddenly occurred to me that my grandfather is dead, therefore you cannot be him. Do you know where I live?
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we are back with the poll list, and this week it's all about Marvel. Jason was kind enough to choose Gambit number 1 for us to read, and I chose Spider-Man Blue number 1. But let's go ahead and talk about Gambit number 1 first. Jason, give us a rundown of that. What is it all about?
It's basically Gambit getting back to what he was before he became a hero, just being a thief.
Okay.
And do you want a full synopsis?
Well, that's up to you. I mean,
he goes to a party, robs a rich guy, and there's a cliffhanger at the end, as there are in most comics now.
Right. Now, it has to be noted that Tommy Lutz, who writes comics for noobs for us, it's up right now. He gave Gambit number 1 an 8.5 out of 10 for art and an 8 out of 10 for the script. I feel that that's a genuine and really honest opinion there, and the reason being is, like with the artwork, Clay Mann's work, it was nice and solid. It was very realistic and modern to me. Great expression for the characters. Jason, what did you think about the artwork?
Well, I love the book in general. Look, I want to start off. I want to say that I'm a huge Gambit fan. He's my favorite X-Man. He's one of my favorite Marvel characters.
Okay.
So I've been waiting this book since I, heard the news months ago. The art's great. The one thing I was really kind of disappointed about when Mann and Asmus took over the title was that they asked if they could change his costume.
Yeah, I didn't like that too much.
I don't know about you guys, but there aren't many characters out there that can rock a brown trench coat with a pink chest plate and get away with it, but Gambit does it.
See, and he even talks about that in the first couple of panels when you see the conveniently covered nudity.
Yeah.
Good start to anything.
Kelly, tell me what you thought about Gambit number one.
Okay, I've never really read any X-Men comics before. I've only seen the movies. But I really enjoyed this.
After me for not watching Firefly.
Firefly is like a staple. Like, okay?
X-Men are a staple. If you've ever read comic books, you have to have read at least one X-Men book.
There's a lot of them. It's really overwhelming, like, where you want to dive in. But anyway.
Okay, go on.
Anyway. I really enjoyed it. I liked the story. I liked the kind of, it's kind of like a thief story, so I thought that was cool. And then I really liked the art. I thought it was nice. I thought it was, I had this kind of soft feel to it. I liked it.
Yep, that's kind of the impression that I got too. With the story, for me, I thought it was extremely well written. Very clever too, like with the way that they had Gambit do things. Like, with that, the guy that was there, Sitch, the bad guy who works for the other bad guys, and when those bad guys don't follow through with what they're supposed to do, he takes their gadgets as payment. So he's got this whole ward in his house that's filled with this stuff, from a sentinel down to the arms of Dr. Octopus. But the way that he had Gambit get the stuff he needed to be able to get in to that room was really clever, and I really dug that. Where Winter Soldier is very spy-oriented, Gambit, this most certainly feels on the other side of the law, and really had me hooked. But with that, Tom, tell me what you thought about this.
Boring.
What?
Yeah, I didn't like it.
Wow.
Tell me why.
It's nothing for me. I'm not a huge Gambit fan. I don't dislike the character. I know that he's a very polarizing character. People either love him or hate him, usually. Nothing really. I mean, what was it? At the end of the issue, what did he steal? A Starro? That's not even the right universe. There were some cool bits, like you said, the way he got into the vault, they illustrated that. That was kind of cool. It was very Mission Impossible-y. What was boring about it? It wasn't engaged. It didn't feel original. It felt kind of retreaded. I feel like the main point of doing miniseries like this, especially with X-Men characters, because as Kelly said, there's so freaking many of them, is when a guy like Gambit hasn't really been used in the X-Men books well for a number of years, and the character even kind of narrates this himself in the book. It's like he doesn't know who he is anymore, so he's got to get back to his roots. So, because we haven't seen Gambit do anything of note in how long? So
a
miniseries like this is a good way to give that character kind of a spotlight adventure, and that's fine, that's nice. Just not anything I would go to get issue two of.
See, the last thing I thought from Gambit was that he was a bad guy. Am I right or am I wrong on that?
You're wrong.
I'm wrong? Well, he was never a bad guy?
The last time we saw a lot of Gambit, he was in X-23's title. He was kind of like her mentor or her protector kind of deal, where he helped her along, like her journey.
Right.
And that's why he got this series, was because the fan reaction, I guess, was so high from that you know, they wanted to give him his own series again.
Well, all right. I can see that. I mean, it's good. I like how they're taking a lot of these characters and really, as much as they can in the Marvel Universe, kind of grounding it in reality. The characters aren't overdrawn anymore or over-exaggerated. They look very human and very real, or at least in the aspect that they can. And that appeals to me.
Well, and it's a good thing for the character that you don't know if he's a good guy or a bad guy,
right. Because
that's the whole appeal of Gambit, is you don't know if he's going to, you know, help you one day and then steal from you the next.
He tightropes on that side of the law. Okay, so Tom, let's get some final thoughts from this. 1 through 10, what do you give Gambit number one?
Didn't they make Gambit a vampire at one point?
No, Jubilee's a vampire.
I can't keep track of the X-Men. I'm going to give the artwork a nice workman like 7 and the story like a 5.
Okay, so a 6 out of 10 in general.
That's not 5.5. 5.5 out of 10.
5.5. Okay, 5.5. Kelly, final thoughts on Gambit number 1. What do you give it?
I give it an 8. I agree with what Tom said, how it's not really the most original story, but I think it is fun, and it's an enjoyable read.
Does it kind of
really good too?
Does it kind of remind you of like the Thomas Crown Affair a little bit? Just a little?
I don't.
No, Tom, you know what I'm talking about, Thomas Crown Affair?
I do. I'm overwhelmed at your ability to grab obscure references.
Am I too young for this? Like, I don't know.
Pierce Brosnan did a remake of it at the height of his James Bond fame. So, yeah, you're too young for it.
Kelly hasn't seen American Beauty, so.
Well, you need to see that.
I'm working on it. There's a ton of movies in my queue.
I will give Gambit number 1 a solid 8 out of 10, both for art and for story. It felt really good to me. It was good to read it. I know Gambit a little bit, mainly from the animated series and in the 90s during the Jim Lee stuff in X-Men. So I've only got that to base on and what I read in X-Men The End. So that's not a whole lot. And it was a breath of fresh air for me to read him and see him grounded in reality instead of twisting the metal staff around and saying a lot of Cajun stuff. But, Jason, final thoughts. Gambit number 1, what do you give it?
All right, I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10 originally, and I'm going to bump it up to a 9 just because I love the character so much. You know what? Just to make up for Tom lowering his back to a 5.5, I'm going to raise mine again to a 9.5.
Wow.
When's Gambit going to destroy the X-Men like Chris Claremont promised?
No kidding.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, not... Okay, all right. We're going to move on. We're going to step it up to Spider-Man Blue, number
one. Hey, Tim, before you do Spider-Man Blue, I know I missed it last week. Morning Glory is number 1, 9.5 out of 10. It was like a clinic on how to introduce characters in an ensemble book. Brilliant.
Such a good book, wasn't it?
Yeah, fantastic book.
I love
You're welcome.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, definitely. I'm gonna keep reading. So move on. Go ahead. Spider-Man Blue, go ahead.
Spider-Man Blue, number 1, written by Jeff Loeb. Artwork by Tim Sale. Colors need to be mentioned by Steve Buscalanto. I may have said that wrong. If I did, I'm sorry. But basically what Spider-Man...
Is that Kermit?
It was, I think.
Anyways.
Kelly, Kermit is a puppet of a frog.
I know that.
Oh, okay.
Did It's Good to Be Green, right?
It's good to be green?
He was a reporter on Sesame Street.
It's not easy being green.
That's what I said. That's exactly
right. Okay.
Okay, anyways, what this book is about is it's Valentine's Day, and Peter Parker has taken it upon himself to record his thoughts on how him and Gwen Stacy met, or almost didn't meet. And the series kind of follows along that line. It takes place during a really important part in the Spider-Man history, and it kind of spans from when Peter and Gwen met to how they fell in love to the ultimate demise of Gwen Stacy, too. But Spider-Man Blue, number 1, specifically focuses on the meeting. My thoughts on this... real quick, with the artwork, it's Tim Sale's artwork. I love his artwork. What he did with The Long Halloween was amazing, and that was my first introduction to him and Jeff Loeb as a creative team together. So reading Spider-Man Blue was a dream come true for me, because one, Spider-Man is my favorite character, and two, those two together make magic in comics, and it's phenomenal what they're able to put out. But Sale's artwork is very retro in style. It's not crisp, which is good. It looks more to me like a freeform art style, not hindered by protractors and rulers. It's more like he just kind of lets his fingers do all the work and doesn't worry about straight lines and jaggedness and stuff like that. But in the same aspect, it's very energetic, too. And Sale's Spider-Man is very classic. And it's a great tribute to the people that did it before him. But you can't compare his work here with the work that he did on Batman, because it's just two different things. But, Tom, let's go with you first. Spider-Man Blue number one, what do you think about it?
I own this in issues, actually, and it's one of the things I've, whittled down my collection that I've kept because it's just a wonderful piece of storytelling and beautifully illustrated, organically illustrated. I went back and read it just about a year ago, I guess, maybe a little less than that, and I remember being surprised because I had forgotten that there are supervillains in it.
That's true. That's true. You get to see great
presentation
of the Goblin in it.
Yeah, I almost, as I remember, I almost thought it was just about Gwen Stacy and Mary Jane and Peter Parker, and I forgot completely that there's actually stuff going on with Spider-Man. It's soap opera-y almost, but I like the dynamic of, and we don't want to turn this conversation into one more day or anything like that, but I like the dynamic of how not just the Gwen and Peter relationship sort of took place, and this is the best retelling of it that there is, I think.
Agreed.
But also how eventually the Mary Jane and Peter relationship took place and what kind of weight sort of Gwen Stacy holds over that relationship and sort of how her death is almost the impetus for
right.
that relationship becoming what it was. Of course, none of that counts anymore. Whatever. It's another conversation. it's a lovely story, and it's a quiet story, which I don't normally associate with Jeff Loeb. And it's the artwork and the coloring is just gorgeous. It's a gorgeous work of comic art.
Right. With the story, how I feel about that story is anybody who's ever had a high school crush can relate
sure.
to this story.
Yeah.
Loeb's writing is superb enough, and it's very comfortable to read. It's something that you would almost sit down and make sure everybody's in bed and just sit and read and spend time with it. Where The Long Halloween was very dark, Spider-Man Blue is the complete opposite of that. It's very bright. It's very exciting. It's full of everything that The Long Halloween wasn't. It's
wonderful. I'd say this is the best of the Marvel color books that this team did, because they did a couple, like Hulk Gray and Daredevil Yellow.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, this is the best of that sort of color books they did.
And it really had that 60s feel to it, too.
It felt like an old Spider-Man book.
Yeah. So Jason, give me your thoughts on Spider-Man Blue number one.
Okay. Let me ask you this. Outside of maybe Bendis and Bagley, and in my opinion, Marks and Banks on Green Lantern. Is there a better team of creators that work together a lot in comics, like in the past 20 years, than Loeb and Sale?
That's a really tough question to answer.
Morrison and Quitely.
Yeah. Okay. But I mean, they're two guys that work together, and they work together very. This is also something that I have in issues. Mine are bagged and boarded, unlike probably Tom's are.
I've got them stuffed under the bathroom door.
it's a very slow, very methodical, very kind of depressing story. Because when you read it, what's going to happen to Gwen. So you start off and you get to see that relationship start in a whole nother generation of readers get invested in it, and then you just know how it's going to end. It's kind of like the Titanic. You know how it's going to end, but the journey's great.
That's right. That's right. And the story that Loeb creates, it really makes you feel about the old times of Spider-Man, and you really get a sense of that innocence that was created back then in the Silver Age and the early parts of the Copper Age. But, Kelly, what are your thoughts on this?
I really enjoyed this. I think it plays out a lot like a really good romance movie. But, but it's got action in it, too. So
yeah, the scene with Spider-Man and the Green Goblin, that was great. That was great.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed that, and that takes me into the colors that Steve Buscellano did. His watercolor style really adds flavor to the series, and it's a great companion to the story and the artwork. It almost is that third that needed to be there. If his colorings weren't there, I don't think that the series would have done near as good, at least for me, because visually the book looks amazing. You know,
yeah, I thought the colors were really lovely.
Yeah. Yeah, so, okay. Oh, go ahead.
Reading this again, am I the only one that kind of was like, to hell with the backstory, I hope Gwen Stacy stays alive in the next film?
You know,
because I want to see that whole relationship play out longer.
I read an interview with, Emma Stone that played Gwen Stacy? Is that right?
Yes.
That's right.
Her and Webb, the director, were talking about how she hoped that Stacy's death really played out on screen the way that it was depicted in the comic books.
So Spider-Man's supposed to be a murderer?
Well,
in the movie, they're not going to let that happen.
I mean, what was that really led to, that it was his fault that he broke her neck? I mean,
yes, they came out afterward and said that he catching her like he did killed her, although she would have died anyway.
See, there you go. So Spider-Man is redeemed. Jason, let's get final thoughts on Spider-Man Blue before we move on. 1 through 10, what do you give it?
I like how you read more things into what we say.
We're not talking about me here. We're talking about Spider-Man Blue.
All right. 8.5 for the writing, 8.5 for the art.
It okay. Was,
so, you know, 8.5 if you can't do math.
I cannot.
It's well.
Okay. Tom lives in New York. He knows one way, and that's it.
I don't know what that means. Go on.
It's a great book. It's definitely worth reading the rest of the series. It's one of those stories that it just kind of sticks with you, I guess.
Yeah.
Not like, you know, we had the timeless stories and all that, but it's a really nice story.
Kelly, 1 through 10, what do you give Spider-Man Blue?
I'd give it a 9. I thought the story played out really nicely. I really like the colors. I think it's kind of a nice departure from, like, just very action-oriented stories that comic books have.
Okay, right on. Tom, 1 through 10, what do you give it?
9.
9, okay, why?
It's really good.
And that's it? Nothing else?
You like to elaborate?
That's really good. You should read it. yeah, you should all read it. Gorgeous art, great subdued story, and it's tough to grade this particular book without thinking of the rest of the books in the series. So if you're going to read one, you should just read the whole thing. It's well worth your time.
And I will give this a straight up 10 out of 10. I loved it. I loved the whole series. I love this issue in particular. I thought that Loeb and Sale did no wrong with anything, with the artwork, with the story, with all of that. It's a beautiful story, and it's one that I highly recommend to anybody who's a fan of comic books in general to check out.
Can I also add, it's not only one I'd recommend that everyone should read, but it's one that is well worth having in hardcover to keep on your shelf.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. With that, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, hopefully Kelly will have a trivia question for us. If not, we'll figure something out.
I got it.
Okay, good. Okay, we'll be right back.
Geek Hotline, how may I help you?
Hello. I was looking for a solution on how to better track my comic book collection. I've been using memory and pen and paper for a while, but it's not really working out well for me. What can you suggest?
That's a very good question, sir. I'll have to consult my fax machine.
I don't understand.
Excuse me, sir. I'm going to have to ask you to stay quiet while I concentrate in order to better serve you. Since you broke my concentration, I'm going to have to go over to my next machine here.
I don't. Why are you using Morse code? I think I better call back another time.
I'm afraid I'm not getting any answer to your question here. Let me just move over to this next piece of technology that I have.
Is that a foghorn? Am I hearing a foghorn?
Excuse me, sir. I'm sorry, I can't get the answer to your question at this time. But if I can ask you to hold the line, please, I will get that answer for you as quickly as possible. Thank you.
Did he just drive off? Heck with it. I'll just use stashmycomics.com.
All right, Kelly, take it away.
Wait, I have to read the rules, too?
Oh, no, I'll read the rules.
You didn't give them to me.
I'm so overexcited. I mean, we've got everybody here, and I'm just ready to go.
Screw it up again, Tim.
I know. Can we do a take two on that? Do we need to?
No, I think we need to let the public know.
It's all your fault, Tim.
You expected me to read it.
Read the rules. Okay. Read the rules, Tim.
The rules. The rules of StashMyComics.com podcast trivia. Number one, you must be a registered member of Stash My Comics to qualify. That goes without saying. If you're not a member of Stash My Comics, you need to stop this podcast and you need to go to the upper right-hand corner of the main page of the website and register. It takes a couple of seconds to do. After that, come back, listen, and win. Number two, when you enter your answer, you must also put your username on the forums underneath your answer so that way we can notify you via private message. Number three, anyone that is an administrator of any form of Stash My Comics or is related to Stash My Comics in any way, Tom and Kelly, you are not eligible to play. Sorry about that, but that's the rules. Number four, the first correct answer wins. Once we have a correct answer, it will be noted on the comments section of that podcast, and the winner will be notified via private message. Number five, if no answer is found before the airing of next week's podcast, then the prize is forfeit, and we move on to the next week. And then we have the Two Guns Initiative. If you win on one podcast, the next week's podcast you cannot participate in, but the podcast following that, you can. Okay, Kelly, with that, go ahead and give us this week's trivia.
Okay, so in honor of Doctor Who premiering this Saturday on BBC America at 9, my question...
Would you work for them?
I'm really excited. My friend has BBC America at her apartment, so I can go watch it.
You can watch the dry version of The Office.
I love all of that Office, okay?
Anyways, what is this week's trivia question?
So my question is, what is the word that the Ninth Doctor says, when he first appears, when you first see him, what is the says?
See, I couldn't even answer that if I wanted to.
Yeah, I looked it up on Doctor Who Wiki, but whatever.
Oh, okay, so now everybody knows where to go.
Actually, you know, that plays in. I wanted to suggest an added rule to the trivia.
Sure.
Number, whatever it is.
Number seven.
Number seven. Rule seven. If you have to look this up online, you're a douche.
Oh, I'll take that.
Won't know, so they just have to internalize.
They have to know. If they don't know the answer, they shouldn't play.
I didn't know.
They should just turn all their televisions off and their computers and cancel their internet service and just wallow in a pit of self-worth and pity. Right. It doesn't matter. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, I'll have my thoughts collected and we'll do this week's weekly distraction, which is editors versus writers. Do editors, Jason, have too much input on what writers do?
Yes.
And what makes a good writer/editor team? We'll be back in just a second.
Subservience.
Do you hold up the line at the comic book shop because you're trying to find a gem mint copy of some random X-Men comic book? Well, you just might be an anal retentive nerd, but I have the cure for you. Introducing the Eniminator. It works just like an enema
for your mind.
You ever get the joke?
your local pharmacy or go to StashMyComics.com for anonymous shipping and delivery, only $9.95. StashMyComics.com is not responsible for bodily harm or embarrassment caused by the Eniminator. Batteries sold separately. StashMyComics.com, powered by Geek Energy.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we are at the point of the podcast where we talk about the weekly distraction. Forget the fact that Hurricane Isaac was a bunch of wind and, like, some rain and not all that.
It was impressive. A hurricane?
Yeah.
That's exactly what a hurricane is, wind and rain.
Yeah, but it wasn't impressive. Like, I wanted the first storm of the year to be, like, dreadful and angry, and it wasn't that, but
can I just say that I really hope for a second that Jason is going to say now is the point on the podcast when we dance. that's an old reference. All right, go ahead.
I know where that comes from. I know Mike Myers is a genius, but anyways, forget the fact that I knew where that came from, Sprockets, and forget the fact that the Republican National Convention was a bust.
Still going on.
Right?
I always think that we're on MSNBC.
Well, yeah. I watch the news all day, so that's what I have to go on.
You have children. You should be watching, like, all day.
I watch my kids.
Don't you have a job? Like, what? I have to go to class. I can't watch the news.
That is my job.
This is a convoluted intro.
we're not here to talk about me. We're here to talk about the weekly distraction. No thanks to Rob Liefeld. Editors versus writers. Do editors have too much to say? And what, if any, makes a good writer/editor team? Jason, you are the editor for StashMyComics.com blog content. You take care of that on a weekly basis. Let's talk about this for a second.
Well, I don't really want to call it editors versus writers. I mean, I try not to, you know, get mad at any of the writers or think that we're working against each other.
Well, see, that's what I want to talk about.
I assume Tom's always working against me anyway, but the other writers...
This is true.
Yeah, see?
Although, look, obviously, I don't think Jason is the editor that Rob Liefeld was talking about. I've yet to receive one email from Jason saying, "Hey, could you change this? Could you, you know?" It's not a good example.
Yeah. It didn't work out this week, Tom. Maybe instead of writing about Maximum Overdrive, you should write about how awesome Tim is. I can see how that could cause a conflict. But
don't worry, Tom. I'll never ask you to write that.
I just don't think the site is the place for fiction.
That's debatable. But we'll get to that in a second. Okay, so that with this, I mean, what Rob Liefeld said, and we only have his side to go on. You know, so what he says is that he had a lot of editorial conflicts and things like that, and a lot of things were changed at the last minute. And when he was working on crossovers with the Superman team would decide something at the last minute, and then that would change the whole aspect of how he had to go about writing his stories. And that's not the first time that's happened. I mean, you get an editor for anything. I mean, a newspaper, a magazine, a comic book, a book or anything like that, and you have the writers that come to that editor and show them their work and tell them their vision, this is how I want it to go, you know, that sort of thing. Those editors are there for a reason, you know, whether it be good or bad, but they're there to help guide and direct that story to make it the best that it can be, and they're there to challenge the writers and make the writers do the best that they can do. But Kelly, let's go ahead and go with you. What are your thoughts on the whole editors and writers things? Do editors have a little more to say than they should in the way stories are written?
I mean, I don't know much about how, like, the editing-writer relationship goes down, and it's definitely dependent on, like, the two people involved. Mm-hmm. But I can see how editors can be more heavily involved, and they should be, and, like, they need to step back and let the writer, like, do their creative process and have the story go the way they want it to go with minimal changes.
Right. Sometimes they just need to let the story breathe. Now, I understand for, like, time constraints and carrying on for too long and so many issues or whatever the fact may be. And McFarlane was a big abuser of that. Like, Torment was great. that was 5 issues long, and it was fantastic. And then he did a 2-issue arc after that. And then the arc after that that had to do with Wendigo and Wolverine, that went 3 issues too long. And I think that's in part because of the editor, because he was afraid of who McFarlane was, and McFarlane was McFarlane, you know, and he's selling books, so just let him write what he wants to write. That's not a good job for an editor to do, you know, to kind of not reel the writer in at that point. Tom, jump in with me. What are your thoughts on editors and writers?
I think every writer will tell you that behind every great writer is a great editor. That's absolutely 100% true. I mean, but we're dealing with what, say, Rob Liefeld was tweeting about, and we're dealing with the big two comics industries. It's a very different relationship, I think, than most writer-editor relationships. Most writers will tell you, most commercial writers, most people who write for a living will tell you, I would not be successful without good editors. And it's God's honest truth, because so often every piece of writing needs a second pair of eyes, and that's who that editor is.
Right.
But the relationship with the big two industries, from what I gather, having never worked for the big two, is you're dealing with creative teams. Look, if a creative team, a writer stays in a book for 12 issues, that's a long run these days, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the editors usually, and Life was complaining, one of the things he's complaining about is that his editors kept kind of, he had like a revolving door of editors. Editors usually stay with a stable of characters for a good long period of time, several years even. And I think editorship and editors at the big two take a much more heavy-handed approach, or they're much more involved in the overall direction of a story because they have to be. Because
right.
The writers of Spider-Man and the writers of Batman, they are not – they're doing work for hire. They don't own the characters. The corporations, the conglomerates own the characters. The publishing houses own the characters,
mm-hmm.
and they're just letting these writers kind of put the words of the characters' mouths, but they need to make sure that the overall storyline, the overall characters themselves
right.
is still the character that they own and they publish. They have that say, and I think that's what's frustrating sometimes, I guess, to these writers for comics.
And in that aspect, in the comics industries, the editors are kind of the curators of their specific
exactly.
continuity. You know, so they kind of have to keep it in line. Go ahead, Jason.
And it's to make sure that the writer doesn't do something that's just completely out of character for who they're writing. Like, if someone came on board and wrote that, you know, Batman brutally murders 3 thugs, well, that's not going to fly with the editor because that's not the character. It has to stay within the framework of
right.
where, you know, the character's history and, you know, how he is.
Right.
That's why getting that. I mean, do you think All Star Batman or Robin would have happened if it was in continuity? No way.
Absolutely
no. Not. It shouldn't either. I would never look. As much as I like the title, it shouldn't. And that's what the editor's job is, to make sure that the character that they're in charge of stays true to what the publisher wants that character to be.
Right. Absolutely. Now, the only experience I have with an editor is with you, Jason, and that's, I mean, it's minuscule things that I do, you know, like forgetting to double space, or not sizing a picture correctly, or adding certain pictures in there, and then you going in and changing those pictures. That's not to be offensive, and that's not to be rude when you do that, but you as the editor have to decide what is the best visually for the articles that go up there too. And I mean, if I choose a picture as a writer of the article, you know, I'm like, I really want this picture in there. Well, no, Tim, that's not going to work because we need it to convey this. Again, you know, that's why you're the editor. That's why I'm the writer. But going back.
Well, look, when I edit something, I never want to change what's being said or change how you're wanting to convey something.
Right.
I'm just trying to edit it, one, for any errors that are made, grammatical, whatever, and then I'm trying to edit it to make sure it all flows and sounds okay.
That's right, but that's the difference between us and the comic book industry. Like where us, we are reporters of the industry, it's not so much a thing of continuity as it is keeping the same style, I guess.
Well, and it's not like I might make suggestions on what kind of content, you know, we have, but I'd never go to a writer and say, hey, I want you to write this week. Like, I definitely would never have asked Tom to write a Maximum Overdrive review.
But I did.
No one asked. But you know what? I think it's within Jason's rights as the editor to say, hey, I want this column.
Right, absolutely. And
that's
then
part of his job. And just like, you know, Tim, I've never, you're saying he'll change the pictures that you send him. I've never once sent in a picture with any of my columns because that's not my job.
I send in mine for Teen Wolf.
I do mine for the articles that I write. Like when I wrote Frost.
No, it's not my job. Not only is it not my job, I don't want to. Because my job is writing. His job is to make sure the site looks like he wants it to look. It's my job is to provide the words, and that's it.
Well, that's right. See, and then there is case in point, because we have a good writer-editor relationship. I mean, we know the boundaries. We know what his responsibilities are. We know what our responsibilities are. But when you get into the comic book industry, sometimes you have those writers like Liefeld or McFarlane, or Jim Lee, for that matter, or Scott Snyder, or Dan Slott, or any of the other big guys that are doing things right now, even Brubaker, for example. You know, they get it stuck in their heads. They know this character.
Only listening people?
Do what?
Nothing.
I'm name dropping. But
I know, you're dropping a lot of names.
Yeah, but they get it stuck in their heads that they know these characters better than anybody else before them, and they know the direction that these characters need to go. Editors be damned. You know, case in point with McFarlane again. Who edits his stuff? He does. That's why it's all long-winded and drawn out over 15, 20 issues and makes no flippin' sense when you read it all. But then you have guys...
Well,
oh, go ahead.
But then you have cases where... I've told you this before, where Grant Morrison wrote Final Crisis, and the editors came in and said, okay, we want to run the story, but you have to make this, and this changed, and then it just made the end product a big jumbled mess.
And that's exactly what it was, and that's a result of bad editing, because Morrison had a specific idea in mind for the story that he wanted to write for what became Final Crisis, and then the editors came in and are like, well, you got to make it match with Countdown, you got to make it match with this, you got to make it match with that, and this and that and everything else. And it just...
It's one of the few comics that had a book, actual novelization, compendium release, because it had to be a companion piece to it to help you understand what was going on.
And we'll talk about that in a crossover classic a couple months down the road. But we're gearing towards the end of this, but I wanna talk about, like, what we think would be a good writer and editor team. Kelly, what do you think makes something like that good?
I think the especially for comic books, the editor definitely has to, like we said, they have to keep the writer, like, on track with the continuity and the characterization, but they also need to, like, be able to step back and, like, just kind of, like, just let the creative process work for the writer and not just be too invasive in what they do.
That's right. When it gets too wild, that's when you pull the writer or the artist back in and be like, okay, you need to break it down a minute, and you need to just kind of sit back and take a look at what you're doing and make sure that it works with everything else that's going on. Tom, give me your final thoughts on this, editors, writers, or what you even think makes a good writer and editor team.
Well, look, I edit it's different scale, but I edit the college newspaper where I work. I'm the faculty advisor at the newspaper, and the guy before me lost his entire writing staff one by one because he would edit the students' work, to the point where they couldn't recognize their own writing, and essentially him writing every article.
Wow.
My job is not to do that, but my job is to edit for clarity and for mechanics, but still maintain the integrity of that writer's written word. And look, in comics, you're dealing with professional writers who don't need, as I would assume, although some professional writers do need it, but professional writers who don't need as much help with clarity, with story structure, with mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas something I deal with all the time on a daily basis, dealing with college students, of course. So the task of the editor in comics is very different. And look, I think 95% of the guys who write for comics are not reacting the way Rob Liefeld does. I think they understand the nature of writing for the big two.
Liefeld is the exception to the
By far the exception. Like Peter David's another writer who's far more prolific and far more talented, in my opinion, than Rob Liefeld. But he also has had his issues with editors and the sort of the structure of how things get done at Marvel and DC at different points. He still writes for Marvel. I'm sure he would still write for DC, but mm-hmm. he left X-Factor back in the 90s because he hated interrupting his story to have to jump onto the latest X-Crossover, which is why it's like X-Factor almost exists outside of the X-Men universe now. Back right. on the book. And it's the best of the X-Men books. That's a personal opinion I just threw in there. So what makes a good relationship? Kelly's right. It's someone who can guide the ship, but can also step back and let the writer have their creative voice. The difficulty with comics editing is that, the writers are not doing creator own material if they work for Marvel or DC. They are doing work for hire, and the editor's going to have the final say in saying how the story goes, and that's sort of the structure that's going to be there, and it's not going to change.
Right. Jason, give me your thoughts on that, editors versus writers.
Again, I don't like editors versus writers. it makes it sound like they're battling each other. After everything with Liefeld happened, I think I said before, Ron Marz, my favorite Green Lantern writer, I followed him on Twitter, and he tweeted
Ugh.
That what makes an editor, or what was it? The best editor is one that will work with you. That's basically what I see. It's not somebody that dictates how they want it done. It's just somebody that will work with you and kind of like just guide you into how they want it done.
Right. Okay.
That sounded really bad. Really, really sexual.
I think that statement, a good editor is one who works with you, was excerpted from Duh, the Journal of the Painfully Obvious.
Well.
Okay. We're nearing the end of the podcast, but before we go, I wanted to ask you guys. I didn't get a chance to do it in the beginning, so I'm going to do it now. Guilty pleasures. I talked about this a couple of podcasts ago, and I mentioned... Night at the Roxbury was one of mine, because I enjoy watching that with my daughter. But I want to talk about that for just a second or two longer before I reveal at the end of the episode what another one of my guilty pleasures are. But I'm almost afraid to reveal it because I don't think I can stand
it. Oh my God.
So, Kelly, give me another one of your guilty pleasures.
I was talking about this earlier before we started this. I really like the movie New York Minute with Mary-Kate and Ashley.
All right, well, look, we can move on from Maximum Overdrive.
I know it's bad, and I know it's cheesy, and I know it's cliche, but I think it's just really fun and entertaining to watch. Well, so I will pull it out and watch it and just have a good time.
I don't feel so bad now.
Hey, Tom, as your editor, I want a review of New York Minute next week.
I am a girl. I can say that I like New York Minute and Mary Kate and Ashley movies, so okay.
Oh. Do you like them when they were the 5-year-old detectives, too?
Oh, yeah, I read their books. The detective stories. Oh, my God, I made my dad read me those, every night for, 3 years.
Jason, guilty pleasure, what do you got? You can't say that because that's a pleasure, not a guilty.
I don't think I've heard a Katy Perry song actually.
Katy Perry,
when she's on, I turn the sound down. I don't know. I can't think of anything right now. There's nothing that I feel guilty about liking.
Wow, Tom.
Come back to you.
guilt. Yeah, you caught me off guard, man. I wasn't prepared for this. Usually we have a very strict outline. You're just going... You're a crazy man, Tim Morse. Jason, you wanted a review of... Wasn't that god-awful movie that Katie just said a second ago? Kelly just said to us, anyway, it's easier, in terms of editors and writers, it's easier for the editor to make demands when the writer is paid.
That is true.
So you can write a review in New York Minute if we pay you?
Oh, hell yeah.
I'll write my own review.
I'll PayPal you a dollar.
There you go.
I might do that. Another guilty pleasure. I read middle grade novels, a lot of them.
I don't think that counts.
It doesn't, because I read them, but I also write in the same genre, so it doesn't really count. I'll get back to you. Let's hear yours, Tim.
Well, okay, we're at the end of the podcast, so I just want to say, ladies and gentlemen, that you need to hit up our merchandise store. Zest.com has bumper stickers, T-shirts, everything that you would possibly need there for Stash My Comics. Get your geek on. Zazzle.com/StashMyComics. Oh, no. What? You guys are still there. Yeah.
What's wrong with Fly? Chicken?
But my guilty pleasure, before we head off the air, I just want to say that I enjoy sitting down and listening to the Spice Girls with my daughter.
That's cute.
Yeah, see, when you say it's with your daughter, that makes it not that bad.
Yeah,
I mean, it's still bad.
Well, would it make it worse if when I was 21 years old, I knew their first album by heart?
Yes.
Well, there you go.
I don't even.
I do.
I believe I own the CD single of Spice Up Your Life. I don't know why, though.
And I didn't like them because they were hot either, or because
they weren't hot. So
they were, though.
They were British.
Yeah. That's why I'm attracted to foreigners.
And terrible teeth.
And terrible
I wanted
teeth.
To be Baby Spice for Halloween one year.
Wow.
Me too. Wait, what?
Yeah. They didn't have a costume in my size. It was just cut.
Me neither.
Wow.
This is when I was little, by the way. It's not like I'm trying to fit into a little girl's costume. They just didn't have my size available.
No, this was last year.
Wow. All right, with that, we're going to hit the road. Guys, we got episode 25 coming up in a few weeks. Please keep an eye out and an ear open for that, because we got a lot of cool things that are going to be taking place during that episode, namely giving away lots of points and some free comic books. But, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us for StashMyComics.com podcast number 22. Once again, we want to thank Matt, our producer, for making the show the way it is and piecing everything together when we give it to him, not in order. Matt, without you, we wouldn't have a show. Ladies and gentlemen, we are out of here.
Spice Girls is better than Maximum Overdrive.
1, 2, 3. StashMyComics.com is the leading free online interactive comic book database. Catalog your comics and track prices, character, and creator appearances. Follow the daily blog reviews, editorials, and a weekly podcast. Connect with other fans through member reviews and discussion forums. Keep abreast of site updates on Twitter at StashMyComics and find us on Facebook. StashMyComics.com, powered by Geek Energy.
Nailed it.